Good afternoon.
Hello.
So last time we finished up with this example here. So here I have some code which creates a thread. The thread runs a function which prints in the thread and then finishes. And when I run this on my machine, about 4% of the time it outputs in the thread, the rest of the time it doesn't. So what happened to make that occur? What's going on? Yeah?
Is it that the parent thread returns, and then when the parent thread returns, it automatically cleans up all the children threads?
So the question is it when the parent thread returns, that it cleans up? So yes, it's something like that. And it's not that it's the parent thread. We don't actually have a parent-child relationship for threads. But returning from main calls exit. And exit exits the entire process, all the threads in the process. So we have what we call a race. Race condition, and we have like a literal race here where it's will main return and therefore exit before the thread manages to print. And the answer is, on my machine, was about 96% of the time it will. And the other 4% of the time it's going to be a little slower because maybe something else was running in my machine that prevented that from running when it was supposed to. So we want something that's going to actually wait for the thread to finish. And it turns out we do have a function to do that we haven't talked about, which is basically going to be our equivalent of wait PID, but for threads. And that function is going to be pthread join. So here's our fix that we have. We start the thread, we print a message about creating the thread, and then we join to make sure the thread actually finishes before we return from main and therefore exit our program. So questions about what I have here? Yeah.
So why is the second parameter null?
So the question is, why is the second parameter null? So the second parameter to pthread join is a place to put the return value of the thread. So in this case, the null, if you pass null for it, you're saying, I don't care about the return value of the thread, which is what I'm doing here. But it's a way that you can have the thread return a value and you can retrieve that. Just like wait PID, you can have a place to put the exit status and retrieve that. So there's another possible solution. So I mentioned that the problem was that when we return from main, it calls exit, it exits the entire process. There's another not recommended solution. Don't do this, but it's a thing which works, which is that we could, instead of returning from main, we could call this special pthread exit function. And what pthread exit says is, don't exit from the entire process, just exit from this thread. And if we do that, we didn't stop the other thread because we aren't exiting the entire process, so it will still be running. So this is a bit different than what you're used to with normal processes where we have this sort of child-parent. That's not actually a thing that happens here. You can pthread join any thread, you can exit, and it stays around as part of the process. We just keep track of all the threads in the process and treat them equally. There's nothing special about the initial thread except that main's return goes somewhere that calls exit. That's the only thing which caused our problem initially. Okay. So we have these two functions. So pthread join waits for a thread and returns its return value by modifying a pointer. Pointer argument with a pointer argument. So We would typically won't use the return value part, which is why I'm not being very precise about it on my slides. I'm going to select wait PID for a thread, pthread xset, xsets the current thread, and it takes an argument. The argument is the same as returning. So here, instead of pthread, so this return null here, is it the same as if I did pthread xset here? It has the same effect. We generally won't be dealing with the return values of threads. We'll have other ways of passing in information from thread to other things. Okay. So we have a way to spawn a thread, and our examples so far have been things like I have a function which always computes pi or prints my class list. But this is not usually how things work. Usually we have some parameters. We want the thread to decide what to do, based on, which thread it is. We want to have multiple threads running the same code but doing different things. So in order to enable that, we're going to want to take advantage of arguments to threads. So I'm going to show a typical pattern for doing some action, split across multiple threads. So here, I have an array of 1,000 items, and I'd like to do the same operation on every single item, and I'd like to do that with multiple threads. My idea is I have multiple cores, I want to use them, so I'm going to spawn multiple threads, and hopefully my OS is going to decide to run those threads on all my cores. Maybe they won't, maybe I'll be unlucky. Hopefully that's what's going to happen. So I have, in this case, I want to spawn two threads, and I want to split up the work between them, and I want each thread to know what work do you actually do. So I need some way of passing that information to the threads. So one simple thing I could do is I could pass the index of the thread as its argument. And in this case, it's going to say, well, there's always two threads, so either I start at 0 or I start at 500, and I move on to do 500 of the 1,000 elements. And inconveniently, for those of you who are used to C++, this is a C API, and they decided I want to be able to pass any value, so I'm going to use a void star for that, so we need to do a bunch of casting to and from void star. And that's pretty much something which is always going to happen here. So I have this I pass in, so each of the threads runs with a different I that's passed in as its argument. So questions about things here? So hopefully when I run this, if I have two cores, both of the cores will be used, one for each thread. And they'll run on the first half of the array or the second half of the items array, depending on which ID they got in. Yes?
So just to make sure, so we can write a any function, but it has to have the parameter void star argument, or type void star.
So the function prototype has to always be void star, yes. In fact, it has to be return a void star and take a void star as an argument. It can be named whatever you want, yes, but that is the only type of function that pthread create allows you to pass it. So other questions? Okay. So you might say, okay, so here we have a way of dividing up the work between two threads. Maybe we can do it for more. So we could have a way of, say, specifying the number of threads. So I just added a global variable here to say how many threads there are. And I'm going to use that and still pass in the indices and use that global variable to decide what part of the 1,000 element array do I use. I'm just trying to divide it evenly. There's a bunch of trickiness with dealing with the edge cases, making sure I don't miss any elements. So that's one pattern here. And this is something you could keep doing, but it's awfully ugly. Like one thing which is ugly is, gosh, we're passing in effectively parameters via global variables. That seems awfully messy and something we were told not to do in some classes, probably. So how can we avoid that? So one thing we could do is we could just pass in a class or a struct pointer. So in this case, I have a new instance of this class I pass in. So I allocate it on the heap. I pass a pointer to that thing on the heap, to the thread. And then the thread, after it's done with it, it deletes it for me. And this is sort of a general pattern you can use to pass in whatever information you want to threads, even though we have this very restrictive, the function has to take a void star as its only parameter. Okay. Any questions? Okay. So that's basic passing data structures to threads, and we'll revisit this in a bit. First, here's some code. This code is broken and will usually segfault. So what's the problem? And you can see here, I'm taking the return value of the thread and returning and, you know, putting it in my string pointer and just printing that out. So the problem is that we're returning a pointer to something that's on the stack, a stack which won't exist anymore when the thread's done. So the way our threads are executed is that we're going to allocate a separate stack for each one. It's going to be a global address space for the whole process. So the same address space, so we'll have our main thread stack, the initial one, and when we start new threads with pthread create, we'll allocate a new stack, typically on the heap. And this is where, you know, string result is allocated, and therefore our string pointer will end up pointing. But when the thread's done, these go away. As we free up the memory, it's probably a heap allocation, so we'll reuse it later on. And the stack is deallocated when the thread exits and is joined. So we won't have that space. So that's something we need to keep in mind, is that just like when calling functions, you have to be careful about things on the stack, you need to be careful about things that are on thread stacks, because if one of the threads goes away, you know, you can have a, yes, you can get a pointer to it, but when that stack is done being used, that pointer now points to something which is deallocated. And this can be tricky with threads because often the scenario isn't as straightforward as here, where it's obvious that we're using it after the thread's done. If we had some way of passing the value before the thread finished, we might start using it and then it goes away in the middle of using it because the thread finishes at some other time. Okay. So this brings up that one thing that our threading implementation is going to need to do is it's going to need to allocate these stacks. And one question you might have is how much space for that. So that's a tricky design decision when you're making a threading system. We can't do the trick that you might be used to of just say, oh, this main thread stack is just going to keep growing until we hit the heap. It doesn't really work anymore. And typically our solution is going to be that we're going to choose a size and that's what we're going to allocate. The other thing is that we need to free up these resources. So one of the things we're going to do is that we're going to decide when they get freed up. And there's two types of resources for our thread. We have our stack and we also have that thread control block. In pthreads, you need to join a thread by default to deallocate everything. So probably the stack goes away when the thread exits, but not everything goes away. The thread control block is still around, as long so you can still pthread join the thread, most likely. Because you're keeping it around so you can collect that return value, that pointer, that hopefully doesn't point to the stack but might point to the heap, and maybe you want that. So sometimes this is not what you want. Sometimes you don't actually care about waiting for the thread to finish, and you don't want those resources sticking around waiting for you to collect its return value if you know it's null and you don't care. So there's an option in POSIX to change this default behavior, which is called detach. So if you call detach on a thread, that says, I don't care about joining this. Please just, when it exits, get rid of all its resources. Don't leave anything around for me to collect later. And you can also detach a thread as part of pthread create. So if you remember when we talked about pthread create, we had this argument that we've always been passing null to here, which is not the, you know, the last argument is where the argument to the function is. So what's this argument? That's what's known as thread attributes. And one of the thread attributes is it detached by default? Do I have to join it or not? So you can set that by setting this atters pthread atter t struct. And this syntax looks like this. I would not expect you to guess any part of that, but you can look it up when you want to use it. And you pass that, and that creates the thread in a particular way. And when we're done, we destroy the attributes of this function because it might be a data structure with like a heap allocation, maybe. And there are other things you might want to control about the threads that are created. And the other notable one you can set is you can say, I want a particular stack size. So you can say, I want my threads to have 32 kilobytes of stack, if you know that's enough. Okay. So any questions about detaching these attributes in general? And as for one obvious issue is like, well, if you don't set this, what's the default? It varies. And there's obviously a trade-off that if you like make the default stack size like 2 megabytes, then you won't run out of stack space, most likely, but also you'll waste a lot of memory if you're like running 1,000 threads. So the default like is not obvious what the good default should be. So let's go back to our notion of passing things to threads and also getting values back from threads in a more typical way. So here I have an example of summing up a bunch of values, and I'm going to compute the sum of the values using 2 threads. And the way I'm going to do this is that each thread is going to take 512 of those values and add them together, and I'm going to pass to the threads this ID number as its argument to tell it whether it's the first half or the second half, and we're going to have all the values in a global array, and we're going to also get our results from each of the threads in an array. And after both of the threads are done, I'm going to add up those 2 results. I could have gotten the results back from pthread join as the parameter. I just decided to pass it in this other way, which often in practice you'll find is more convenient. So we have these values and results, which are global variables. So this is one way you can pass things between threads. So here I'm passing information to the threads, the list of numbers to add up, and information from the threads, the sums they have via global variables. So you might say this is awfully annoying, because what if I want to sum 2 things at once? What if, you know, want different sizes? Can I do something other than use these global variables? So let's do something better for passing the values back, but I'm going to still have a global variable for passing the actual values. So here, now I'm making this code more generic in that I'll have the same code in threads no matter what subset of the numbers they get. So I cannot change my thread code when I decide to say, oh, I don't want to divide it up two ways, I'm going to divide it up three ways. And I'll just pass in this little data structure here. Start, end, result. So I'll pass my start and end, and I can use this, again, to pass back the result. So rather than having a global variable for the result, I just have it, the thread, write into that data structure its result. And for main, I just read from the pointer I passed it, from the array I passed in pointers to, those results. Questions on what I've done here? So what I have is I have this info array in my sumAll function, and I pass pointers to different parts of it. And this is in fact a pointer to the main thread stack. So I have my info, and my infos and both of the two threads I'll run are going to probably be stored in the thread stack and point to the main thread stack. And you might say, gosh, we shouldn't be passing pointers to stacks. This is okay only because I know that I'm waiting for the threads to finish before I let them actually stop using that, before I actually deallocate the thread info I passed to them. So yes, they have a pointer to another thread stack, but that's okay in this case because I'm being very careful that the thread is done using that pointer before I let that pointer become invalid. And I still have a global variable for the values. So this is the scenario I'm left with, if you pardon that these arrows probably should point in the other direction. So I have my info array on the main thread stack. Each of the threads gets a pointer to it, and that's where they're storing the results, but they're acting on this global values. Okay. And we can get rid of that global array by passing a pointer to where the array is as part of our info. So now we have code which is better as far as we're concerned for, making sure we don't have global variables and this code is really modular maybe. And so we end up with a scenario where each thread has their myInfo variable, which points to the info array. That's where they write the results. And that's how they find out where the values are, which could be on the stack, could be on the heap. We don't know. Doesn't matter. We have the same code for all the cases. They just use that pointer. Yeah. They have pointers, so why do they have pointers is the question?
Why do they point to the main thread stack?
So the question, why do they have pointers? So here, we're passing in this argument, which is a variable allocated on the main thread stack.
Okay.
And that's why they have pointers. So this myInfo, because of the argument, is exactly a pointer to that. And the same thing is true when we get rid of values.
Okay.
But now that pointer also tells you where to find values. Okay, so questions about this procedure? And this is a typical way you might see people write threaded code, is you spawn a bunch of threads to do something, you pass in a struct to them, which has all the information for the thread all together. So both the information the thread needs, and it's one of the most convenient ways of having the thread set stuff back to you, even if that stuff is like more complicated than what you could pass via pthread exit or get via pthread join, more than just like a single value pointer. So here, we're relying on the threads having a pointer to the main thread stack, which means that we have this main thread that runs all these other threads, and the main thread has to be around for the entire time that we're running this. We can relax that by saying, well, I didn't need to allocate this array of thread info on the stack. I could have just allocated it on the heap. And that lets me split up my sumAll function into two separate functions. And now I don't have pointers to stack. So I have a start function here where I create a bunch of thread infos on the heap. I pass pointers to each part of that to the threads. And I have this finish function where I actually use the thread info I originally allocated, wait for the threads to actually finish, and then sum up the results, get rid of the heap allocation, and return my results. And as part of doing this, I need to keep track of what the thread IDs were, the pthread Ts, or remember our thread IDs, like a process ID. And a convenient thing to do, like I could have put it elsewhere, I could have like had another array for thread IDs, but since I already have this one array, I decided, well, I can just add an element to the struct, and that's how I decided to keep track of those. So questions on how this code works? Yeah. Question is, does the new keyword indicate it's being allocated on the heap? Yes, that is how C++ works. This is C++ code, not C code, by the way. If we were using C, we'd probably use malloc and have to not say thread info, but struct thread info. Okay, other questions? So in this situation, what we're left with is that we have our myinfo pointers now point to an array on the heap, which has pointers to our actual values, which, well, they could be anywhere because it's whatever was passed to this start sumAll function. Okay, so any questions about these patterns? So this is, yeah, the purpose of this is to show you, like, these are a bunch of ways of passing things to threads. Given that the pthread API seems very awkward for that, because what do you do with a void star? And this is what you can do with a void star in order to pass things to threads and pass things back from threads. Okay. So I went over sort of the most basic pthreads function. So we have pthread create a new thread, which is, you know, which we found out works differently than for processes. It doesn't split our thread into two threads. It just creates a new thread starting at a particular location rather than copying our current stack or something like that. And pthread join, which is to wait for a thread, and we have the option of not using pthread join with pthread detach. So all these functions, and most of the functions in POSIX, have some cases where bad things can happen. So one example is, well, I need to allocate a bunch of space for my stack. What if I run out? Eventually I'm going to. And I need to allocate space for the thread control block. What if I, you know, run out of those? So in fact, there are errors that pthread can return. And pthread return, pthread create, and pthread join, and most of the pthread functions return errors in a different way. So we're used to from fork, you expect fork to return -1 if there's an error, and then you look in this ErrorNo variable, which you might have found with perError, or you might have just ignored it and printed out fork failed, but you're supposed to look in the ErrorNo variable for what happened. Pthread create works differently. Instead, they return the error number as the return value, or return 0 if everything's okay. Notice that the thread ID is actually an argument you pass in a pointer to change. So that's so the returning the thread ID is different, unlike fork. And I entirely omitted error checking on this slide, and this slide, and this slide, and every single other slide I have shown any pthread calls. that doesn't mean I want you to omit error checking when you write pthread code. But I omitted it because I want to keep my slides from being even more cluttered than they are. But you should probably actually check errors on functions. Our Pachidaso book, the one that's a free PDF, they recommend just having wrapper functions for all the pthread functions that check errors. That's what they do. But like, you probably in real code should check for errors for a lot of these functions, and you can find out in the manual page how that works. Typically, it's this strategy where it will return zero if everything's okay. It will return the actual error number otherwise. So your error checking is going to look something like this. And typically the errors are going to be things like, you know, this E again, insufficient resources, create another thread. Like, we run out of stack space, we don't have another thread control block in our constant size array of thread control blocks or whatever. So any questions about error checking? So, goes to our next topic, which is about sort of, now that we know how to spawn threads, how do we make sure threads behave correctly? And this is going to be a topic we'll spend a lot of time on because it turns out to be incredibly tricky. And the issue is that threads are non-deterministic. And they're non-deterministic not because they inherently have to be, but because of our schedulers. We typically do not have a scheduler where we can say the same thing's going to happen every time on any real system because, well, exactly what gets scheduled when depends on what other programs are running. It depends on like exactly when you press a key, when that program will start running. So even with a single core, things are not deterministic. You know, it's going to vary even if you run the same program over and over and over again. And we already saw that with this example, where I had a different thing happen 4% of the time because my scheduler behaved differently. And a question we'll have is, given that we have this sort of non-determinism, how do we make sure that our threading programs that might need to do things more complicated than what we showed for as far as sending information from one thread to another, how do we make sure that they behave the way we expect? And you know, our traditional solution of, you know, if it passes the test cases, it's good, doesn't really work in this universe. We're going to reason in other ways. So we're going to try to design things where we're going to have some tools that are going to help us make sure we know what's going to happen is going to be consistent every time when we follow some rules. And we're going to talk about that a bunch for next several weeks. But first, let's go over sort of the types of cases we're going to be concerned about something might go wrong. And I know that this is going to be worse with multiple cores, before we move on. Like, multiple cores are also non-deterministic because like we have different caches and it depends what's in the cache, how fast things run. It makes this problem way worse. So let's do our classic example of things that can go wrong with threads. And in order to have things go wrong, we need to say like both what our problem is and what our correctness goals are. So our example is going to be, task is going to be an ATM server. So a server that like, where we have a bunch of ATM machines that all use this one machine to process the transactions. And this has a bunch of commands it can run, and most importantly, withdraw and deposit. And our correctness goal is don't lose money. That the amount of money should not, like we should not have money disappear or get duplicated. Like the books should balance out when we're done. So this is an example which is a good way of explaining what these problems are, but please don't take the impression that this is actually how bank systems work. Bank systems use a very different strategy to deal with these problems that we probably won't talk about, that you might learn in a database class. Okay. But here, you know, in our naive notion of how this system would work, we would say, well, we're going to have a bunch of accounts, and there's some data structure for an account which has a balance, and like we retrieve the account from our database, like from a file on disk or something, or we find it in memory in our map, and then we store it back, you know, make sure it's updated. You know, and maybe in the fast case, this just reads it from a hash table and makes sure and does nothing if it's already in the hash table, and if it's not already in the hash table, it reads it from disk into the hash table and then returns that. And our server, you know, it just reads a request, figures out what the operation is. Is it a deposit? Is it a withdrawal? And then runs one of these functions. And our multi-threaded version, we're going to say, well, I'd sure like to handle more than one deposit and withdrawal at a time. After all, I have all these ATMs. I should have them all work together, take advantage of having multiple cores. So we're just going to run multiple copies of this server loop at a time. And that does seem kind of silly, but there are reasons to do this. So like maybe get and store account are sometimes slow. Like sometimes it's in memory and they're fast, but sometimes we have to read from disk and that's really slow. We don't want to stall everyone's transaction because one person has a slow thing to read from disk. And maybe the logic has, you know, isn't as simple as this deposit method. Maybe we have a whole bunch of other checks we need to do that might take a bunch of time. So we'll have lots of threads running this server loop. Okay, so this is the hypothetical scenario we have. And notice that I spent time justifying why would we ever have multiple threads running this server loop. And that's because you probably should have a reason to use multiple threads, given the sort of issues we're going to come up with. Okay. So let's say we have two deposits to the same account at the same time. One of them happens in one thread running the server loop. Another happens in another. Maybe they come from two different machines. Two people have access to a joint account. They both deposit some money. And here is our assembly code for implementing exactly this line, account balance plus equals amount. We assume they both call get account. They get a pointer to the same account. You know, it's not in memory, we don't have to load it from disk. So we take the account balance, we move it into RAX, then we add the amount to that RAX, and then we take the RAX and move it into the account balance. So that's our assembly for implementing this line. So very straightforward assembly. Like maybe the compiler could have done better, but it's pretty good. And you certainly wouldn't be surprised if your compiler did that. And here, I have a way for running two copies of this, that thread A, we're going to run the first two instructions, and then we're going to get really lucky. And a context switch is going to happen exactly then. You know, this is even on one core, we have a context switch exactly then. And then thread B runs two instructions, and then it gets really lucky, and a context switch happens exactly then. Then thread A runs. And a context switch happens, then thread B runs. And what's going to happen is that we're going to add thread A's amount to balance, store that in RAX. We're going to then read the old balance. So we have our, you know, let's say our balance is initially, let's say, 100, and thread A's amount is 10, and thread B's amount is 10. So RAX is going to be equal to 100. We're going to get compute 110. Thread B, well, we haven't written to balance yet. So thread B, running after this context switch, is going to say, oh, the balance is 100. It's going to add 10 to that. Then thread A writes 110 to balance. Then thread B writes its 110 to balance because they have independent registers. And our two deposits of $10 end up giving us $10 instead of 20. So we lost money. And we can call this a lost write, that we had a race to write back results to balance before someone else read them, and it didn't work out. And thread B's deposit is the only one that's reflected. The other one is lost. And this happens even on a single core. We just have to get really lucky with how our scheduler runs. And because our scheduler is non-deterministic, like depends on when interrupts happen and what else is running, you know, this is going to happen, you know, every once in a while. And going to be virtually impossible to reproduce in tests. Okay, so questions about this scenario? Okay, so let's think about what happens here, you know, in general, when we have two threads trying to access the same value. Like here, we have two threads trying to access this count balance. And I'm going to do this with sort of abstract examples with just some variables x, y, and z. So let's start with this. So initially, x, y, and z are 0, and we run the following assembly equivalent to the following, assign 1 to the shared thing x, assign 2 to the shared thing y. What are the possible values of x? This is the easy question. So what are the possible values of x after we let both threads run? Someone? So thread A writes 1 to x, and thread B writes nothing to x. And so after both of them run, hopefully we've written 1 to x and nothing else happened. Started out at 0. So the x is going to be 1. Thread B doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. All that matters is thread A runs. Thread A runs, it sets x to 1. That's the easy case. So let's try this one. What are the possible values of x? So thread A is going to, its code is set x to y plus 1. And thread B sets y to 2, and then sets y to y times 2. That's the assembly equivalent to that. So what are the possible values of x here? Someone want to tell me at least some of them. So 1 or 3, so how do you get 1?
Thread A goes first.
Okay.
It just adds 0 plus 1.
Okay, adds 0 plus 1, okay. And 3?
If thread B does its first step first,
okay.
Thread B2, and then X will add 1 to it.
Okay, yeah, those both work. Anything we're missing? Yeah.
B5 too.
5? How do you get 5?
Because both of B's instructions could run, so Y could end up being
okay. Yeah, so y could be 2 times 2. So we got all our possibilities. It's 1 or 3 or 5. That's what it seems like the possible values are. Okay. How about this case? What are the possible values of x? Yeah.
It would be 1 or 2.
So 1 or 2, yes. Now, and that's what people generally say. That seems like the most obvious answer. But there's a question I'd like to ask is, why aren't you saying 3? Like, maybe we set each bit separately. Like, could we do that? Maybe. So we actually need to define more about what actually happens when we assign a value in order to actually reason about this stuff in any meaningful way. Because, like, you can see the logic, like, if we set each bit separately, well, of course it could be 3. We could somehow come up with order that we set each bit, this assignment turns into setting a bunch of bits one by one in some random order, and we end up with 3. Like, that probably shouldn't happen, but it seems like a silly way to implement it, but how do we, like, say what things are actually possible? So we're going to define a notion of what we'll call an atomic operation. So this is something which is going to happen runs to the completion all at once or not at all. Completion, this is without interruption, not at all. And these are the things we're going to use to both reason about what's possible and to let threads work together. And one of our atomic operations is that usually loading or storing words is going to be atomic. So some notion of a word, the native size of a machine, usually loading a value from a word is going to be atomic. We're not going to load it bit by bit and possibly read part of a write, but not all of it. We're not going to store it bit by bit for storing it. We're going to store the whole machine size values, like the whole 32-bit x. We're not going to store each bit of x separately and write load each bit of x separately and possibly see in-between values. And that's what we're going to be concerned about. And this is really important when we talk about multiple cores, because in multiple cores, we literally could be running two instructions at the same time. We need to know, how are they allowed to interfere with each other? And the rule generally is that most machines, if it's a word, like whatever the size of a normal register is, you can load or store that much, and it's going to be all at once or not at all. Now, you might say, well, of course, but instructions are going to be atomic, right? And you know, some people might have pointed out, if you remember your x86 assembly really well, you might say, hey, this assembly code, you know, that's silly. Because I know x86 has an instruction where you could like add a value directly to account balance. And that seems like it would prevent this problem, right? If instead of moving account balance into a temporary, adding to the temporary and storing it, we just added with one instruction, well, we can't set up context switches, so there's a problem. It seems like that would solve this if we just had one instruction for this. And on a single core machine, it absolutely would. We couldn't set up this scenario. But on a multi-core machine, we have to ask what things actually happen all at once. And it turns out that some instructions don't happen all at once. And one of those instructions on x86 is a normal add instruction that adds to memory. That instruction internally is executed as if it were those separate steps. So if you have two cores, one of them, they can run those separate steps and have them interleave, so we have that problem. And you can see this empirically. So here, I have a little assembly function which adds one to a global variable using that single add instruction. So one instruction, adding one, and decrements a counter and has a loop. So we just add one a number of times equal to our first argument, and I'm passing in an argument here of a million. So each of these runs a million times. So I run two threads which run this loop a million times, and then I get the result of the value afterwards. And our expected thing is if this was actually atomic, if it happened all at once, all together, without interruption, we'd say each add happened separately, we have a million plus a million adds, so our final result, if the value is starting at zero, is going to be 2 million. But that's not what's going to happen, because this is not atomic. The add instruction is actually implemented by separating the read from the write. So there's going to be a temporary value in the processor's implementation of this. That's going to mean that we're going to have this time where we can have that lost write, even though it's one instruction. That the implementation basically divides it up into these smaller instructions that run at the same time on the two cores. And we can see this empirically with the results I get from this program. And this is probably not the histogram you were expecting. Remember, our expected value is 2 million. And not only do I not typically get that, I don't even get close to that. What's even more confusing is I somehow get below a million. And this is because it's split up into multiple steps. And as part of making the processor fast, they really don't want to have to read from memory all the time. So they're actually pretty aggressive about not sending values back to memory, and that's why you see this sort of behavior. So it's implemented with multiple steps, you know, more complicated. So this tells us that if you want to like coordinate things between multiple threads, we need to be told what operations are safe. You can't assume, oh, it's one instruction, how could you mess that up? You have to be told. And the way you're going to be told is the processor designer is going to tell you. They're going to tell you this operation is safe. Or occasionally the library designer will tell you. So pthread join, yeah, it does the right thing, and you know that because the documentation for it will tell you that yes, this is designed to do the right thing. It will use instructions the processor designer said were safe to implement it. So there's not that this type of problem. So the processor designer is going to design things so that we don't have this problem. And it's going to tell you which operations they've designed in that way. And in the case of x86, this add instruction is not one of those. There, in fact, is one that works very much like this, but it has different assembly. Okay, so questions on these atomic operations. Okay, so we're going to assume that loading and storing words is atomic. That loading a 64-bit value with a move instruction and moving it back is atomic. And something we'd like to do is we'd like to make, given that, our original example safe. So we're going to work up to building an abstraction known as a lock. And we saw a lock earlier with our scheduler, which is going to say only one person, only one thread at a time gets to use our account. So we're going to work on building it up, and I'm going to use a more human example because it helps kind of reason about what's going on here. And we're going to try to build that from knowing that loads and storings of words is atomic. But at least we have that. We know that that operation happens all at once. So how can we build this sort of one player person at a time does something? In the case of our deposits, it's one person at a time adds money to the account. I'm going to use a different example, which is, let's say we have some roommates, Alice and Bob, and they have a fridge, and they both want to buy milk for the fridge, and they don't want to both do it at the same time. They don't want to both go out for milk, to buy some milk for the fridge, and then find out that, well, that's more than you wanted, and it's going to go bad. So, the typical thing which might happen is Alice arrives, looks in the fridge, oh, there's no milk, okay, she goes to the store, she comes back, and she goes to the store, and while she's at the store, Bob looks in the fridge, comes home, finds out, oh, there's no milk, he goes to the store, and as this is happening, too bad, Alice already bought some milk, and then they both put milk in the fridge. So let's come up with a solution for this. So if you were solving this in person, what are some solutions that would avoid this problem? Yeah.
Alice tells Bob before she leaves that she's gonna go get milk.
Okay, so Alice tells Bob. So let's say Bob's not home yet. What can Alice do instead? Okay, so leave a note saying, I'm buying milk. Okay, and we can represent that note as like storing something to a global variable. So our procedure is going to be so we're gonna leave a note and we're going to check the note, check for a note. Okay, so our store is leaving the note and our load is checking for the note. So we're going to add that operation and see how things go. So here's our implementation of that. If there's no milk, I check, is there also no note? And if so, I leave the note, I buy the milk, I remove the note. Okay. And And this would work in person. So let's do this solution here. So let's talk about, you know, so this is my code for this. So no malloc is just checking, you know, basically global variable, is there malloc? No note is checking a global variable, is there a note? Then we leave a note. So here is a potential timeline. So Alice looks at the fridge, says, oh, there's no malloc. Checks for a note, nope, no note. Says, okay, I better start writing a note. Meanwhile, Bob, next to her, looks in the fridge, says, huh, there's no malloc, and there's no note. Okay, better start writing a note. And Alice leaves her note, buys some malloc, removes the note, then Bob leaves his note, buys some malloc, and removes the note. And we have the same problem we started with, because computers don't quite work like humans do. Okay, so anyone have a fix for this? Yeah. Okay, so you want checking for malloc, the whole thing to be atomic. That's our goal, but we want to build that from our, you know, something like our note writing primitive, because that's all we have is our built-in atomics. But yes, if we could add atomic operations, it becomes much easier. Yeah. So start writing the note. Okay, just leave a note, sure. So we leave a note when we're, before we start checking. We just leave a note saying, because the problem was that Bob didn't notice that Alice was already checking and gonna deal with it. So we leave a note before we start checking, and we check, did we leave a note? You know, is there a note? Does this work? You might say, okay, that doesn't quite work because the code I wrote doesn't work because there's always a note. Yeah. Another problem which would have happened in person, so we never buy malloc any amount of times. But we can improve that because obviously you'd say, well, you're not checking for your own note. You're checking for a note from Bob or Alice. So we'll just have a separate note, a place to check for each note. So in code, instead of having a, you know, an int note, we'll replace that with an int note from Alice and an int note from Bob. So we'll just have two places to check depending on whose note it is. And then our code is Alice leaves a note, then checks if there's no malloc and if there's no note from Bob, and if so, buys malloc. And then, or Bob leaves a note, checks if there's no malloc and no note from Alice, and if so, buys malloc. Yeah. Still doesn't work, yes. So it still doesn't work. And the problem is that now Alice leaves a note, and then Bob leaves a note, so they're both checking at the same time. We don't actually prevent them from both checking at the same time. So they're both checking at the same time. They realize the other one's checking, so I don't need to check. I don't need to buy malloc, Alice will do it and vice versa. So no one ends up buying malloc. So you have the opposite of the problem we started with. Okay. So the main purpose of this is to point out that, gosh, actually doing this mutual exclusion thing, which is what we're gonna call this, we want one person to do an operation, excluding everyone else, is surprisingly hard with the obvious, like, I can read and write memory operation. Like, even though in person, like, this is relatively easy to coordinate, like, it doesn't actually work out when you write it as an algorithm where you just say, we can leave notes, well, of course, we can solve the problem that way. Doesn't quite work out. You might say, well, is there a solution? And the answer is, oh, yeah, there is. It's not what you expect. So I'm gonna have one version. is here. So Alice leaves a note and keeps checking for a note from Bob. And waits until Bob doesn't have a note being left anymore. And after that happens, Alice checks if there's no milk, then if so, buys milk, and then removes her note. And Bob leaves a note, check if there's no note from Alice yet, and if not, if so, just removes his note immediately, otherwise goes and buys milk. So you might say this is an awfully ugly solution because everyone's doing different things. And this is basically, you know, this is something you kind of need to end up doing, as it doesn't end up being symmetric when you try to solve this problem. And it's kind of ugly. And like there are like other things you might want to do, like, okay, I'm telling you that this is a way to solve the problem, and you're going to look at it and say, okay, but it was really hard to figure out last time that we have these like tricky cases where it didn't work. How do I know those don't exist here? And well, you can prove that by enumerating all the possibilities and figuring it out, but it's really hard. Really hard. Another thing you might say is, okay, so this is our solution for Alice and Bob. What happens when we have, you know, more roommates? Like, what are we going to add to make this work? So there is a general version of this known as Peterson's algorithm. You can look it up on Wikipedia. We will not be using it. This is extremely ugly. So while being able to read and write things from memory is enough to implement this, do have locking where one person does something, one person modifies the account balance at a time, one person buys milk at a time, one person accesses the list of processes at a time. It is enough to implement that for multiple cores with just this atomic load and store. It's really inconvenient. So we are not going to use that mechanism. Instead, we're going to rely on special hardware support. We are going to have the hardware add extra instructions for us to make implementing this easier, so we don't need to reason about things like this. Not that we couldn't, just that it's not very convenient, and it's actually relatively easy for the hardware to provide us operations which will make it way simpler to implement locks, that one thing at a time exclusion. And we're going to have some vocab terms. So what we're going to end up implementing is what we'll call mutual exclusion, which is the property that one thread does a thing at a time, like our buying milk example. And we'll call the code which runs with mutual exclusion, the code which runs one thread at a time, that code we'll call a critical section. Oh, and I have this should be the result of mutual exclusion. And we'll call a lock an object that only one thread can hold at a time. And this is an interface for creating critical sections that will have this operation for a lock where we acquire it, we hold it, and only one thread can do it at a time. So while we're doing that, we have mutual exclusion. Only one thread is acting at a time. And by surrounding our code that we only want one thread to execute at a time with locks, we'll have that code be a critical section. Questions on these terms? Okay. So what we're going to have is our lock primitive. So it's going to have at least two operations, acquire and release, or lock and unlock. You'll see both names. We'll end up using both names because pthreads uses the names lock and unlock, and xv6 uses the names acquire and release, but they mean the same thing. And the idea is we have this object, we do the lock operation, and it waits until the lock is free, and then grabs it, until you unlock it, which lets others use the lock, waking them up, stopping them from waiting. Okay. Questions about these operations? So with our milk example, if we have a lock, this is our algorithm now, is that we have this lock. Either Alice or Bob acquire the lock, and they know once they've done that, there's no worrying about notes anymore. They're the only one checking for milk right now. Now then they go out and buy milk and come back and unlock it, and now there's no conflict. Okay. And pthreads has this. So the most common type of lock in pthreads that we'll use is a mutex. So here I've declared a mutex, you init. There's an init, there's also a destroy. Probably should have shown. Destroy. And it has a lock and an unlock operation. The init takes this null argument that can have attributes, just like for threads, they can specify extra settings about the lock. We won't talk about them very much. Okay. And XV6 has locks which it calls spin locks. So we have the name mutex for pthreads and spin lock for XV6. And the spin lock, you declare like this, struct spin lock and the name, and you have, there's an init function, and then acquire and release. The init function takes an argument, which is a name to be used for debugging output for the lock. And we saw this with the scheduler code with our lock for the process table. So a brief note on C++ and locking. So an interesting question is, can you use a vector for multiple threads? And this is not obvious, because how does a vector work? Does a vector like have a counter inside it, maybe? Does it like randomly reallocate things when you access them? You actually need to know that it doesn't do that. And the way you know is by reading the documentation for the C++ library, you know, which tells you what the rules are for whether you can use things like vectors for multiple threads. And the general rule for C++ is that you can access, you can read things as long as it's not being resized for a vector. And you can modify things as long as you're not resizing things for multiple threads, as long as each thread is modifying different elements of the vector. And that's the general rule for C++ containers. Multiple threads can read them at the same time, and multiple threads can read an element of the vector if no other thread is modifying it. You can read it if no other thread is modifying it, but you cannot access things which might be being modified by another thread at the same time, no matter what the modification is. And you can only add or remove elements from any C++ container with some exceptions if you read really carefully, but in general the rule is only one thread at a time can change the size in any way of a container safely. And this is not an inherent property of the C++, you know, vector and so on. It's just these are things that the people writing the C++ language said, we're going to provide you for multi-threaded code. So this tells you that if you want to just read from a shared vector, you don't need any locking. If you want to modify different things from different threads, you don't need any locking. The moment you want to add things to a vector for multiple threads, you need locking, even if only one thread is modifying and the others are only reading, because that violates this only if no other threads are accessing it rule. Okay. So questions about this? Yeah. So the question is, what happens if you violate these rules? Well, what's going to happen is you're going to get, you know, race conditions like our example here. You're going to get wrong answers and all sorts of wrong answers. Or you might get segfault. So like for a vector, what might happen is you read from a vector while it's being resized, and the thread that's reading tries to access the freed memory before it was resized. And you get a segfault. And in all cases, it's only going to happen when you get lucky enough, like this example here, so you won't consistently reproduce the errors in the test, which is why I'm telling you rules to follow and not like things to test for. Because you when you violate those rules for C++ vectors, it's just, you know, in other C++ containers, you're just going to get weird behavior that only happens sometimes. Okay. So our next topic is going to be, I told you about the abstraction for Luxar, and I showed you that we're going to need some special hardware support to implement them without going crazy. So I'm going to talk about that in a bit. First, I'd like to mention our next homework. So after the shell homework, we have our lottery schedule homework I mentioned earlier. I will have it marked as not tentative tomorrow. It's usually, most people find it much simpler than the shell, except it does involve code in XV6, which is a bit harder to debug. So time may vary, but usually people find it much simpler. So you need to track the number of ticks each process runs. We need this because we're implementing a scheduler. We want to know how the scheduler's doing. It's really annoying to figure out how the scheduler's doing if we don't have some logging of how much time things run. We have a system call getProcessesInfo with an extra S, which copies information from the process table to user space so I can write a test program that figures out what things are running and how long they're running. We have a system call to set the number of tickets, because for the lottery schedule algorithm, you have a number of tickets, we run a lottery, whoever has the winning ticket runs. And you just choose pseudo-randomly weighted by tickets. Note that we don't have floating point in XV6. You cannot use floating point because the XV6 kernel doesn't support staving or restoring the floating point registers. It also doesn't support turning on floating point, so if you try to use it, you will get a crash. But most importantly, if you just turned it on, that wouldn't solve the problem because it won't save or restore the floating point register, so wouldn't really work. Okay, so any questions about this assignment? Okay, so in that case, let's go on to our implementing locks, and I'll start with the easy ones, the ones we can definitely talk about in our remaining time. On a single core, implementing locks is actually fairly easy. You only have to worry about one core. Remember that the only problem we could have which could interfere with any operation is if we had a context switch. So we just need to prevent context switches from happening. And the only ways context switches happen are if we make a system call that like request one, like reading from the keyboard, like request that we give up the CPU if there's no keyboard input yet, or if an interrupt happens, like a timer expires or IO happens. So the simplest way to implement locks on a single core system is just disable interrupts so there's no context switches, then nothing else can run. So here's my lock implementation. I didn't even bother taking an object as an argument. We just disable interrupts to lock, enable interrupts to unlock. And this works in the simple cases, but there's some problems. So can someone tell me one problem with this scheme for implementing locks? Yeah?
System calls, they might yield.
Okay, so system calls yielding, so that's a problem, yeah. What if we want to do I/O while holding a lock? We can't do that. Any other problems? Okay, so one issue is that this would be unacceptable as a user mechanism because if we expose this as something for your programs and not just for the kernel, then now you can hang the system by having buggy lock code or intentionally buggy lock code. Yeah, and you mentioned the I/O issue that if we read the lock, if we went to do I/O, this doesn't work. If we try to read from the disk, the OS is going to wait for an interrupt from the disk, but we've disabled interrupts, so we're never going to get it. So that will also hang the system. Another more subtle issue is that we can't do nested locks. With this code, we need to do something a little different. And the problem is that, you know, we don't want to enable interrupts before we're done. So what's our solution for that? Yeah? Yeah, so we just keep track, we increment a counter every time we lock, we decrement it when we unlock, when that counter goes to zero, we enable interrupts again, not before. Okay, so that's the strategy. So as long as we don't, so we have these problems with things that user programs want to do, but this is a real way you can implement locks. An XV6 spin lock does two things. So for single core, it does exactly this strategy. So the push CLI operation increments a counter, disables interrupts, and increments a counter. And the pop CLI decrements the counter, and if it's zero, re-enables interrupts. Exactly what you described. And this is one of the things SpinLock does. This is how it handles single core, and we'll talk next time about how it handles multi-core cases.